So welcome to episode 25 of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell. I'm a family physician, professor at the University of Georgia, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus, an evidence-based online reference for primary care, urgent care, and emergency physicians. Please check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. I think I should know that by now. Subscribers get access to this powerful primary care reference and also get all poems sent to them in their email inbox, which is about 25 per month. The opinions expressed are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. I'm joined again this week by Dr. Henry Barry and Dr. John Hickner. Henry, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Actually, I'm excited. It's been a year since our first podcast, and it hasn't felt like it's been a year since we've been having so much fun, having three friends and colleagues nerding out, and it's been a lot of fun. For our listeners, if we're meeting your information needs, great. But if there are things that we can do better to meet your information needs, please let us know.
Yeah, that's a great thing. We do pay attention to those comments. And if you want to shoot me an email, it's my last name, ebell@uga.edu. I'd love to hear from you. And I'll share that with my colleagues as well. John, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm excited as well. I'm excited to see you, Mark, once again. We're going to meet up in October in Cleveland at the Cleveland Clinic Evidence-Based Medicine Primary Care CME, which is October 18th and 19th. Look it up on the Cleveland Clinic website, on their CME website, and hope to see you all there as well.
Yeah, I think we're going to be joined by our colleague Gary Ferencik from Michigan State. He's an internist, but we let him play with us. And Gary's a great guy and great educator. And we have a lot of fun teaching that course every year. I think we've been doing it for 7 or 8 years now, I think, something like that. So it's fall, and with fall comes, you know, football and fall weather and fall color tours, but also influenza. And Baloxavir is a new drug on the scene. It's called Xofluza is the trade name. And I'm going to be talking about a slightly older trial that we missed. And you know, I try not to miss anything when I cover poems, but this was one that slipped through the cracks. So we've written it up this month. It'll be in the poems. And what we have is a clinical trial published in the New England Journal. It's called Baloxavir Marboxil for Uncomplicated Influenza in Adults and Children. And the question is it a safe and effective treatment for influenza? I got to clear my throat out a little bit. Let me see. That's at 3 minutes. Okay. So the investigators recruited patients who were 12 to 64 years with flu-like illness for less than 48 hours. They all had to have a fever, at least one respiratory symptom like cough, and it had to be moderately severe, and they had to have at least one systemic symptom. So that's a group. If they get moderately severe and have systemic symptoms and have fever and do it within 48 hours, there's a very good chance during flu season that they have influenza. The patients 20 to 64 were randomized in a 2-to-2-to-1 ratio to Baloxavir, based on weight-based dosing. It's 40 or 80 milligrams in a single dose. Tamiflu, 75 twice a day for 5 days, or placebo. The younger group of 12 to 19-year-olds, there was no Tamiflu group. They just were randomized to Baloxavir or placebo. About 3/4 of the patients came from Japan. The rest were in the U.S. I believe this pharmaceutical company is based in Japan, and that explains that. About half of the patients were recruited within 24 hours of symptom onset, about half between 24 and 48 hours, and that ends up being kind of important. Of the 1,436 patients who were randomized, 1,064, so more than 2/3, had influenza confirmed by PCR. In the entire group population of all patients with influenza-like illness, Baloxavir did reduce the duration of symptoms, a median of 23 hours, which is the same as Tamiflu. If you look at only those who were later confirmed to have PCR-confirmed flu, it worked a little better, 26 hours, again, about the same as Tamiflu. The key point is that the benefit was a lot greater in terms of symptom reduction if you could get to them in the first 24 hours than if they were treated between 24 and 48 hours. The difference was 33 hours fewer symptoms versus only 13 for those in the later identification group. Both drugs were generally well tolerated, about 5% nausea and vomiting with Tamiflu, which we all know about 2% diarrhea with the baloxavir, but really minimal nausea or vomiting. So it's a little bit better tolerated. It is a single dose, and those are the primary advantages. Bottom line, though, is that it has similar effectiveness. We don't know about long-term effects. We don't know about rare safety issues that could crop up sometimes once you get something out into a much larger population. Cost is about $160 versus $40 on goodrx.com. And we don't have any data on the effect on complications like mortality or pneumonia or hospitalization. The randomized trials for Tamiflu show no benefit for those outcomes. There are some observational studies that have suggested a benefit in terms of mortality pneumonia. So costs more, doesn't work any better. Sounds like a home run to me. John, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with you. It's a me too drug, no question about that. That's overpriced. And unless they bring the price down, I don't think they're going to sell a lot of it. I don't think this company is going to make a lot of money off this drug at any rate.
I think they're going to make a ton of money, unfortunately, because people don't care how much a drug costs because doctors too often aren't aware or are more concerned about the patient in front of them than the cost. And yeah, I understand that. And patients will like the idea of just one pill, you know, one and done. So I don't know. Henry, what do you think?
Well, I'm suspicious. So, Mark, you made reference to your meta-analysis and certainly the Cochrane meta-analysis of oseltamivir and zanamivir several years ago. The challenge was in identifying all of the available data and the selective publication and suppression of high-quality information that would have made relevant decisions that people were making. So I went to clinicaltrials.gov to see what's out there. And there are four completed studies, only one of which actually has results, and that's the one that you just reported. Now, two studies just completed the recruitment of patients earlier this year, so we have to give them a break. But there's another study that was completed in April of 2018 in high-risk patients, and I went to PubMed, and there is nothing. So I think this is the first study, and quite often what we have found over the years is that the first study often becomes a bit more, gets a lot of notoriety, and the subsequent data are not quite as promising. So I think for many reasons, this is one we should stay tuned on.
Yeah, I think the high-risk study was published as an abstract at a national meeting, but that was a while ago and has not been published since then. So I'll be curious to see what that shows. You're absolutely right about the publication bias. When I did our systematic review, we found, I think, a total of 11 studies of Tamiflu, but only three had been published. And we had to look at the clinical trial reports that the FDA had for the other eight. And so, and among those that were suppressed were the study that showed that treatment 24 to 36 hours barely worked. That was suppressed. The one in high-risk patients, which showed no benefit, that was suppressed. And the one in elderly patients, which showed no benefit, that one was suppressed. So they claim they just didn't have the resources to publish it. You know, that's a bunch of hoo-ha. Of course, they've got the resources to publish it. They didn't want to publish it. And that's what's led to a lot of the controversy around Tamiflu is, you know, if someone tosses a coin 50 times and only shows you when it comes up heads, you're going to think, boy, that's a, you know, kind of a great coin to have. But if they're suppressing those other 25 flips of the coin, you know, that's a problem. So we need to stay tuned on this one. I'm skeptical of the value of these drugs in general. I think they do have a role in patients who are sick enough to be hospitalized, in patients who are high risk for complications like pregnancy. Even though we don't have great data, I think it's sensible to treat patients, you know, in those situations. But for the typical healthy person coming in with flu, I really don't think too much of these drugs. So we got a quiz, and I think, John, I think it's your turn to do the quiz this time.
Yes, Henry passed it off to me. So here we go, which is in line with the poem that Henry will be presenting a bit later. Which of the following statements is true regarding treatment of chronic non-malignant pain and chronic opioid use? A, about 10% of patients prescribed opioids by physicians become addicted. B, opioids are not effective for treatment of chronic pain. C, non-opioid treatment regimens for chronic pain can be as effective as opioid-based treatments. D, long-term randomized trials of opioid treatment, that is 6 months and longer, show that opioids are effective for chronic non-malignant pain.
We need somebody to say, stay tuned, Henry.
Stay tuned.
There we go. Okay. It's practically trademark now. Our audience is expecting it. So, John, it's your turn to talk about subclinical hypothyroidism.
Yes, I love this poem, which is a bit different because this is a summary of a practice guideline, not a summary of a randomized trial or a meta-analysis. This was published in BMJ just this year, volume 365, and called Thyroid Hormones Treatment for Subclinical Hypothyroidism, a Clinical Practice Guideline. Now, this guideline is based on a systematic review of 21 studies with over 2,000 participants. The developers evaluated the effect of treatment on quality of life, symptoms, and mortality, and they focused on adults older than 30 years old. The guideline developers were an ad hoc group of methodologists, general practitioners, endocrinologists, and yes, patients with subclinical hypothyroidism. In other words, the guidelines didn't come from a professional society. No members had financial conflicts of interest. The group used the GRADE approach, which is one of the best for guideline development, to create the recommendations. Now, based on moderate to high quality evidence, thyroid supplementation as compared to placebo has no effect on quality of life or symptoms for patients with subclinical hypothyroidism with a TSH up to 20, a lot higher than our traditional cutoff of 10. These patients all had normal free T4. They looked at harms, but they did not find a lot of evidence because harm was not frequently studied, especially cardiovascular events and mortality. So at least in these studies, there was no downside that they could detect. So I think this is really a marvelous poem and a marvelous guideline because they have all of the interested parties around the table, because they used a great grading system, that is the GRADE, because there were no conflicts of interest. So this is a very well done guideline, and I think is likely to change our practice because I think most of us tend to start thyroid supplementation if the TSH goes above 10. Henry, what do you think?
Yes, I agree. This is a great guideline. I think in some ways it may change practice. We also need to reflect a little bit. In recent years, we've actually made it easier for patients to have subclinical disease. If you recall, the upper range of normal for TSH levels was dropped to 4. So we have a whole bunch of patients out there with values between 4 and 10. And so the changes that's suggested by this is that if we're going to be using TSH levels as a starting point, which I think is good practice, if we have an abnormal TSH, what we should be doing is following up then with a T4 level and then base initial decisions on that subsequent thyroxin level. And so to me, this was a practice changer.
Yeah, you know, I think I speak with someone with hypothyroidism, and sometimes the symptoms can be subtle. The first thing I noticed was more difficulty than normal, and I was always pretty good at calculations, numeric calculations in my head, and I'm a quantitative person, and I started having more trouble, you know, at the grocery line counting up what I thought the bill should be, that kind of thing. And I thought, that's odd, and it turned out my TSH at that point was around 10. And I followed it for a little while, and then it went up to 16, and, you know, the symptom persisted and just some other vague symptoms, and I decided to be treated. So I think we do need to take into account, you know, each patient individually and, you know, really carefully assess those symptoms. And, you know, I guess I think in terms of the harms, I think, you know, we are always concerned about overtreatment, but in this case, I think overtreatment, the main concern would be if you drive the TSH down too far and you have some cardiovascular risk. But other than that, I don't think it's very harmful. So I would say, I think it's a great guideline. I agree. They did a fantastic approach to doing this. But I think, particularly in those patients in the 10 to 20 TSH range, I'm still going to keep that treatment option open, I guess.
Very reasonable.
I try to be reasonable all the time. Let's see. It is Henry's turn. We're going to hear about, obviously a very hot topic in the U.S. and elsewhere on opioid use disorder in primary care.
So this paper by Koronik and colleagues, published in the Canadian Family Physician in May, asks the question, can opioid use disorders be managed in primary care settings? So this was really yeoman's effort. They searched multiple databases. They tried to identify published systematic reviews and randomized trials in the last decade or so. And they were looking at primarily studies that might be relevant to primary care settings. So they had many dimensions of this topic, and I'm only going to cover a couple of the outcomes. They looked at things such as morbidity and mortality, societal outcomes such as crime, incarceration, employment, hepatitis translation, quality of life symptoms, as well as opioid use and treatment retention, which is going to be the focus of my review. They found 39 systematic reviews, an additional 26 randomized trials, a cohort study, and a partridge in a pear tree. Four of the randomized trials directly evaluated primary care treatment of opioid use disorders, and they found that patients were much happier, more than three quarters versus roughly a third of the controls, as well as higher rates of retention, almost 90% compared with 67%, and street opioid abstinence in more than half compared to a third in the controls. So these were the basis of the recommendations. They found a paucity of data looking at how do we identify patients, but found two tools that might be useful. One is the current opioid misuse measure, or the COM, and the prescription opioid misuse index, or the POMI. The COM is only six items, whereas the POMI is 17. The POMI has higher discriminating capacity with a positive likelihood ratio of 10 compared to 3. So those are two tools that we could certainly use. When they looked at medications, turns out that buprenorphine, either alone or combined with naloxone, kept more patients in treatment than placebo, with a number needed to treat of about 4. And similarly, methadone and naltrexone each kept more patients in treatment than placebo. There were some head-to-head studies and that methadone was more effective than buprenorphine, with a number needed to treat of 7, but it also had a much higher rate of sedation. And so there's a lot more in the paper, such as supervised dosing, speed of tapering, psychosocial interventions. This is a paper you should get and read, because frankly, there is nothing in this paper that suggests to me that this is something that we cannot do. The main work is in the area of regulatory issues and payment models. And the good news is that I think that there's movement on both of those fronts to make it easier for us to treat these patients.
Thanks, Henry. That was a great poem. And I saw in your write-up, it was all caps toward the end. You should get this paper. And you don't use all, you're not one of these people that uses all caps a lot, but it sounds like one our readers should really look for. And as a reminder, it was in the Canadian Family Physician, which is an open access journal, volume 65, page E194. So page E194, volume 65, Canadian Family Physician. And yeah, the screening tools, I was interested in that in particular, the current opioid misuse measure and the POMI. The USPSTF just released a draft recommendation. And previously, they had said there was insufficient evidence regarding screening in primary care using one of these tools or similar tools for opioid use disorder. Their draft recommendation increases that or changes that to a B recommendation, which is something that, at least for the screening part, you could now bill for. And it's not going to be without controversy. One of my side gigs is to review all of the comments from the public and from other organizations to the task force when they release a draft guideline. And I can tell you, we've already gotten over 200, which is a lot. And there are a lot of very upset people out there who read this and interpreted it as the government is going to come and do mandatory drug screening using my blood and urine. Now, that's not what they're saying, but be prepared for some controversy when this really hits the news. The other is pushback from some, you know, family physicians, primary care physicians who are concerned about the impact on practice. Is this something that's going to, you know, affect our relationship with patients? Is this something we should be doing? It's another thing they're making us do or asking us to do. So I think there's some legitimate concerns around implementation. But once you identified somebody, then I think clearly this is a very helpful paper to review. Any last thoughts on that, John?
I don't think this is going to be for all family physicians, certainly. But if there are enough family physicians that are willing to take this on, that would be a tremendous service to society, because I believe that there will never be enough addiction centers to successfully manage these folks. And they may, in fact, be better managed in primary care, where they can get their other healthcare issues addressed as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think we all, you know, kind of believe that at our core, and that's a big part of why we became family physicians. So, John, it's also your turn to review the quiz answer. Why don't you talk about that?
Yes, I will read the question and responses one more time so you get one more opportunity to think for the right answer. Which one of the following statements is true regarding treatment of chronic non-malignant pain and chronic opioid use? A, about 10% of patients prescribed opioids by physicians become addicted. B, opioids are not effective for treatment of chronic pain. C, non-opioid treatment regimens for chronic pain can be as effective as opioid-based treatments. And D, long-term randomized trials of opioid treatments, 6 months or longer, show that opioids are effective for chronic non-malignant pain. So it's important for primary care physicians to understand basic facts regarding the use of opioids for chronic non-malignant pain. Although we seek to minimize use of opioids, it's likely that many patients will continue to use them for chronic non-malignant pain. Here are the results. Answer A is incorrect. About 5%, not 10% of patients who are prescribed opioids by physicians for pain become addicted. That's good news that 95% don't, but we have to remain alert to signs of addiction when we prescribe opioids in all patients. Answer B is incorrect. Meta-analyses actually show that opioids are modestly effective for relieving chronic non-malignant pain, of course, at the cost of side effects and potential addiction. Answer D is incorrect as well, because no randomized trials, except the one I'm going to mention in a minute, have been more than 6 months in duration. Most were only 12 to 16 weeks. Answer C is correct. A randomized trial performed in the VA system and published in JAMA last year showed that a non-opioid regimen was as effective as an opioid-based regimen in relieving pain and improving function at 1 year follow-up. That's also a study that you should consider reading and perhaps putting the abstract on the wall in your offices, in the exam rooms. That was published in JAMA in 2018, volume 319, number 9, pages 872 to 882. There we have it.
All right. And we covered that study in Poems last year. I remember that one. And I think I remember talking about it in the CME courses because it was such an important trial. And of course, there have been a number of other trials for acute pain showing that you can do just as well with non-opioid. And one thing I always remember is that, you know, the predictor, one of the key predictors in observational studies of who eventually does become addicted or develop a misuse disorder is the size of the original prescription. So, you know, if it's the dentist giving 90 hydrocodone following an extraction, or the orthopedic surgeon giving, you know, 90 oxycodone after a knee surgery, you know, that is where the root of the problem can sometimes lie. So great talking to you guys today. Thank you for the discussion. Listeners, please tell your friends, colleagues, share the links with them. We'd love to get more people listening to Primary Care Update. Vote for us or rate us on iTunes, even if you don't like us. And we'll talk to you soon with more Primary Care Updates.